So last time we were talking about economic systems, and we got to the point, and we're sort of just reviewing here, and that's, you know, what is the system, the economic system in the United States? What process or processes do we use to determine how to use our resources? Another way to say how to use our resources is to say what to produce, what not to produce, and the things that we produce and what quantities to produce them. And then another big issue is, once things are produced, how do we decide who gets them, how those goods and services are distributed, right? So I know this would make a lot of members of the Tea Party furious, but we happen to live in a mixed economy. Everybody pretty much lives in a mixed economy. So in our economy, all the decisions are not made by the market. And we reviewed last time some of the other processes that are very significant in terms of how we decide what's going to be done. Okay? So we talked about how a lot of decisions are made by the government. The government doesn't pay us to agree, for example, that we should attack Syria or not attack Syria. There's a government process, a political process, that will make that decision. We mentioned last time that the taxing capabilities of the government have nothing to do with the market. You getting taxed is not your entering into a voluntary transaction with the government. The government says you have to pay taxes. And that's all there is to it, unless you have some argument about why the Constitution says you really don't have to pay taxes. But if you make that argument, you typically end up in jail. So a lot of decisions are made by the political process. A lot of people, some people anyway, for example, members of the Tea Party, think that's bad. They think that fewer resources should be allocated by the government. Now, they would probably tell us that they'd like more resources allocated by the marketplace, but I'm not sure they really believe that. Maybe they think there's lots of things that the government's doing that actually the individual should do through command and control. The individual should be able to do whatever the individual wants. Or things that should be determined, for example, by the family. You know, but in general, there's lots of people on the right end of the political spectrum who think the government has too much control over the allocation of our resources and the distribution of our goods and services. We also talked about, in our economy, a lot of things are determined by command and control, not by the market. So I tell my daughter what she's going to have for dinner, but I'm not really in control. So then she tells me what she's having for dinner, and then she's got the power, so then I make her what she wants. Because I know if I make her what I want her to eat, she probably won't eat it. Right? You know, who you have sex with or don't have sex with is not determined, well, maybe for some of you it's determined by a market transaction. But for most of you, it's not determined by at least an explicit market transaction, right? You know, you think about daycare, stay-at-home parents, that sort of thing. You know, you tell your three-year-old what to do. The parent, at least when the kid is small, it's definitely a command and control relationship. A lot of resources get allocated towards the baby, but the decision to do that and what those resources are going to be is determined not by a market transaction. The baby is not buying dinner from you. You determine what the baby's going to eat, how the baby's going to be fed, what kind of crib the baby's going to live in, whether they listen to Beethoven or they don't listen to Beethoven, all that kind of stuff. So yesterday, a very famous economist died, a guy named Ronald Coase. And When I heard this on the news, and I didn't quite know who they were talking about or whether the person was dead or not, but I sort of realized halfway through that they were talking about Ronald Coase. He was 102 years old, and he won the Nobel Prize in Economics a number of years ago. Not that many years ago, maybe 1990, 1995, something like that. And he wrote this very famous article about why we have firms. You know, why are there firms in the economy? Why is there such a thing as IBM or Google, right? So I'm going to switch the notes around here a little bit, but I had this job one summer working in a factory, and in this factory we made diesel engines. So this was a really crummy job, by the way, but it paid pretty well. So I worked on this assembly line. So I stood in this line, and there was a guy to my left, it was all guys, guy to my left, guy to my right, and there's this whole line of engines here, and behind us there's all these parts. So my job was to put a certain part on the engine. So the guy next to me, he'd put the part on the engine, and sometimes the thing would work where, it wasn't always like this, but the machines would move really, really slowly along the line. They'd never stop moving. And it was sort of timed just so you'd have enough time if you worked really fast to get your part on the engine. So the engine would move along. I'd reach back here. I put the part on the engine, crank it down with my crescent wrench and my tools and all that kind of stuff, and then it would move on to the next guy. Now, why did I stand in that particular place? Because that's what I was told to do. I was told, stand here, put this part on in this particular way. So my boss told me what to do. And I was also told to do it in a certain amount of time. Like if the engine made it past me and I hadn't put the part on, I'd get in trouble. So once my decision to work in the factory was a market transaction. They hired me for the summer to work in the factory. Basically because my father knew somebody there. But anyway, that was a voluntary transaction. But once I'm in the factory, how my time is being allocated is being determined by command and control. Now, I want you to think about how that process would work if instead of me working inside a firm, everything was determined by a market transaction. So instead of having a boss, everything that happens is determined by the market. The guy standing here looks at me and says, Edward, do you want to buy an engine? And we'd negotiate over the price of the engine. I'd hand him a bunch of money, and he would move the engine down in front of me. Now I own the engine. Then I turn around, and there's some guy who owns water coolers who's standing back here. We bought the water coolers from someone else or the parts, and he made the water coolers back here. So I turn around and I say, hey, can I buy a water cooler from you? I give him some money. We negotiate a market transaction. Then I need some bolts, so I turn to this guy over here and I say, can I buy some bolts to put this thing on? And then I get all done with this, and then I look at this guy next to me and I say, hey, you want to buy an engine with a water cooler on it? And then we negotiate. So this would happen at every step of the process. If the way we built engines was completely by a market process. But why don't we do it that way? It's crazy. It would take, there's all these transaction costs. Every time an exchange is made, there's got to be a negotiation, money. We spend 90% of our time just haggling with each other about what to do. It's much more efficient to do it dictatorially. Sometimes the market is not the best way to organize economic activity. And that's why firms exist. And the person who first pointed that out was Ronald Coase, the guy who died yesterday. That within the firm, Resources are not allocated by the marketplace. It would be, in that context, inefficient. It would take way, you could do it using way less resources and way less time if there's just a boss telling everyone what they have to do. Think about if there weren't firms that served food. So there was no manager of the restaurant. Most of you have probably worked in a restaurant. So, Paige walks in the door of this building. She sits down at a table and she wants something to eat. So let's say I'm in the waiter business. So I'm my own little operator. So I walk up to her as the waiter and I ask her what she wants to eat. She tells me, I say, oh, we can't do this or I can't do that. I can serve lobster, I can't serve scampi. We agree on what she's going to eat. And then she pays me, maybe then or maybe afterwards, she pays me a certain amount of money, and I agree that I will produce food on the table for her. Then I go back to the kitchen, and I find some guy who likes to cook. And I hire him to make scampi or whatever it is she's having. But then I run down to the corner to the fisherman and I negotiate and I buy some scampi. And then I run somewhere else and I get some lettuce and I buy it from the lettuce guy. And this goes on and on and on and on. All these market transactions. And then I sell her the prepared meal. Now, is that how we make food typically? No. That's not how restaurants work. Within a restaurant, within the firm, meal preparation is not being determined by market transactions. Now, of course, the restaurant bought a certain amount of scampi. They bought a certain amount of lettuce. They hired you. They hired me. They rented the building. But once they've done all that, who decides how the meals are going to be prepared, what they're going to cost, who's going to do what? The boss. It's determined not by a market transaction, but by command and control within the confines of the firm. It's kind of ironic in a way, because we think of ourselves as living in this big market economy, but in our market economy, are all the firms really small? No. We have these humongous firms. So a lot of our resources are being allocated within the firms, not by the marketplace. And why is that? Because it's cheaper to do it within the confines of this organization called a firm by command and control than to have everybody an individual operator who's just continuously trading with one another. It's gone. Where'd it go? There's something. See if there's any more down here. So, when we think about a firm, again, it gets its inputs by entering into a market transaction. It hires you. That's a voluntary trade between you and your employer. It also buys a bunch of inputs from other firms. Parts, if you'd like. Lettuce, lobsters, that sort of thing. At the other end, once everything is produced, again, there's a market transaction. It sells these things in the marketplace for money. A voluntary exchange between the seller, the firm, and the buyer, the consumer. But in between has nothing to do with the market. let's assume that that was it. Okay, we're going to switch gears here a little bit now. And we need to talk about a couple more important things. Stuff that's talked about in the first couple chapters of your book. We need to talk about marginal analysis, what that means. We need to talk about specialization, what that means. The concept of equilibrium. And then how economists go about judging whether the processes we use and the outcomes are good outcomes or bad outcomes. You know, for example, why do economists often like markets? They don't always like markets, but how do they decide whether a policy is a good policy or a bad policy? So as an environmental economist, you know, one way, let's say you wanted to make people smoke less, would be to raise the tax on cigarettes. The idea being the price, including the tax going up, would reduce the demand and fewer people would smoke. So let's say we were proposing a $5 tax on every pack of cigarettes. How would an economist decide whether that was a good policy or a bad policy? What criteria do economists use to make that decision? So let's start off with marginal analysis. So we're going to have short explanations here. We're going to go back to a lot of this stuff later on. But what's that burger place that the local Colorado, Good Times, right, that serves organic beef and all that kind of stuff? Right. So, I drive back and forth a lot between here and Steamboat. And often I drive with Sophie, my dog. So typically, not always, but imagine we stopped in Silverthorne and we stop at Good Times. And typically, I'll get a bag of French fries and she gets a paw bender. Does anybody know what a paw bender is? It's an ice cream sundae for dogs. It's got a biscuit on top. It's peanut flavored. It's pretty good, actually. And they freeze it, so it's really hard. So she can't make a mess of it. She can take it in the back seat and, like, lick it slowly for a long time, right? So she likes paw benders a lot. I usually get French fries. So let's imagine that I've pulled out of Good Times. We're going down the street. And I've got this bag of French fries. I don't know, 31 or something to the bag. I'm looking at the French fries. They're sitting there. Should I eat one French fry? Should I eat the first one? I just bought them, right? So I must have bought them with some expectation that I was going to eat them, right? But I have to make the decision. So I go, yeah, let's eat one French fry. So what am I doing? I'm making a marginal decision. I look at the benefits to me of eating the first French fry. I look at the cost to me of eating the first French fry. You know, I might drive off. What are some of the costs? I might drive off the road, picking up the French fry off the floor. So I somehow increase my chance of dying in the car by grabbing, looking down and grabbing for French fries. What are the benefits of me eating French fries? I'm going to starve to death if I don't eat the French fry? That might be true of some people, but it's probably not true of me. Why do I eat the French fry? I enjoy it. It's got this what? Fat. This combination of fat taste, you know, that fat molecules in your mouth, that sort of greasy mouthfeel, you know, combined with what? Salt. If you go to McDonald's, it even has some sugar. They spray sugar water on them. Did you know that before they fry them? So sugar, salt, fat, and crunch. At least for the first one, you can't do much better than that. It's really good, right? Is there a cost to eating the French fry?
Not very healthy.
It's not very healthy. Well, why not? Because of the fat, sugar, and salt. So it increases the chances I'm going to what?
Die of a heart
attack. What's it going to do to my waistline? It's going to increase my waistline. Are there some other costs? I'm going to get some grease on my mouth, maybe. My power to weight ratio. So if I'm on my bike and I'm trying to climb up the ward, you know, I'm going, shit, I shouldn't have eaten that last French fry, right? But coming down, I can go flying by those little shits, right, who only weigh 130 pounds, right? All that weight, that mass is just driving me down the hill, right? So there's some advantages to being heavier, right?
But
yeah, the aerodynamics kind of sucks too, you know. Anyway, so I eat the first French fry. What's the question then? I have to make the same decision again. Do I eat a second French fry? So how long do I keep eating French fries? Now, I already bought the French fries, but the cost of the French fries is sunk. I've already paid for the French fries. Do I eat all the French fries in the bag? Yeah, I have to. It's like God said you bought these, so now you've got to finish them. No, you could think like that, but an economist wouldn't think like that. An economist would say what? Just keep eating French fries until the cost of eating another one is greater than the benefits. Might the benefits go down as we eat more and more French fries? Yeah, the first one tastes really, you know, that greasy, slimy. Well, slimy is not the right word. Fat has what? Fat has an incredible, what's the word that connoisseurs use? Mouthfeel. That feel of the, like, slippery fat molecules rolling around inside your mouth. She's going, ew, yuck, right? Well, after a certain number of French fries, the chances of me it going from, oh, this feels great and tastes great, to, ew, this is kind of yucky, start going up. Okay? So the benefits I get from each additional fry go down. So I drew some pictures, okay? Now in my case, what happens is that if the marginal cost to me gets greater than the marginal benefits, I stop eating French fries, and who gets the French fries? Sophie the dog, right? Now, Sophie the dog always eats all of the French fries. Now, in her life, we're comparing French fries to dog food. She doesn't get a chance to eat fries as often as I do. She's not that worried about, you know, dogs don't die of heart attacks or heart disease. Does anybody know why? They don't live long enough. They don't live long enough to get heart disease. It's kind of a sort of a good deal in some sense, right? You can eat all the steak and all the fat you want without ever worrying about it killing you because something else is going to kill you before it would kill you, right? So her benefit cost lines and mine are different. So, keep things simple. Benefits come in terms of taste and the elimination of hunger, and costs are future fat around my hips and waist, grease on my mouth, clothes, car seats, everything, you know? There's some people who won't go into my car because, you know, there's old French fries on the floor and in the seat cushions and all that kind of stuff, right? Which is another good reason to have a dog. But okay, so the marginal benefits and the marginal cost of eating another French fry. So the blue line is going to be the marginal benefit. So the benefit of the first fry, and God knows what these units are on the axis. Let's call them pleasure units or something. It starts off pretty high. I get a lot of benefits from the first French fry, whatever this numerical scale is. But then the benefits keep going down and down and down. Now, until finally, around 20 fries, it crosses the line at about 21 fries. So that means, Sophie, if there's like 31 in the bag, Sophie's going to get 10 fries or something like that. If what? If there was no cost to me of eating additional fries. So the red line is going to be the marginal cost to me of eating additional French fries. But let's pretend there's no cost for now. There's no red line. How many French fries would I eat? Pardon? Let's be careful here. I get 100 units of pleasure from the first one. How many units of pleasure do I get from the 20th one? Close to zero. How about the 21st? The 21st, I'm indifferent. If I go past that, I'm like the woman back there with the blonde braid. They're just grossing me out. Actually, eating another one, the pleasure is negative, if you'd like, right? So I wouldn't eat every French fry in the world or even every French fry in the car. I would stop at 21 if there were no costs. If French fries were true in my car were truly free, right? But there's a marginal cost eating French fries in terms of increased chance of getting fat, heart attacks, grease, etc. So that's the red line going up. So how many French fries am I going to eat? I'm going to go to the point where the marginal benefits of another French fry equal the marginal cost. I'm going to eat, what? I don't know, 17 French fries, something like that. And Sophie's going to get the rest of the French fries. So, what is the black line then that I threw in? The black line is the blue line minus the red line. So you start off at 100, so the black line is the blue line, like 120 minus 5 or something, so it's right below it. And then the difference between the blue and the black line is the red line. So we can think of where you want to go, if you're into marginal analysis, as the point where the blue line and the red line cross, where marginal benefits equal marginal costs. The black line we could describe as what? Marginal benefits minus marginal costs. So let's call that net benefits. The benefit you get from an additional one after you subtracted out the cost of the additional one. And you want to keep consuming as long as the net benefits are positive. But if the net benefits are negative, you've consumed what? Too many. How do you think the shape of those lines would differ across people? So we would expect the curves to look different for different people. We still could keep the units the same, right? So the units on the axis, whatever they might be. What are you eating?
It's like a Greek yogurt granola bar.
Okay, so she has a yogurt bar. She's already paid for the yogurt bar. So it's a question of how much of it is she going to eat? The whole thing, you think? Yeah? If she eats the whole thing and she's a rational economic being, it means what? The benefit of each additional bite was greater than the cost. Now, I could possibly change the cost of her eating it right now by saying, let's all watch her eat the yogurt bar. Is she drooling? Is her mouth open? Let's all watch and see, right? Now, if I did that, what would that do to her red line? It would shift it up, and it would make it more expensive on the margin, and she'd probably take, what, fewer bites. Okay. Now, imagine how the French fry thing would vary across people. So, let's say you're a male. There's lots of those in this room. 18 years old. More people. Named Bubba. Anybody here 18 male named Bubba? Who weighs over 250 pounds? Any takers? You want to volunteer to be Bubba?
I'll be Bubba.
He'll be Bubba. Okay. So, you can be the skinny rich bitch from New York City, right? You're 45 years old. You only wear Chanel clothing, right? How does his blue line differ from your blue line? Yours starts at a what?
It's going to be steeper.
Steeper? Well, do you think, before we think about whether it's steeper or not, do you think it's going to start? If his starts up at 100 and something, where do you think yours is going to start? 50 or something. So, you know, French fries are good, but, you know, you don't like them. You're not as much into that fat mouthfeel as he is. Now, steeper would mean what? You'd get grossed out faster, right? Like, the first one's great, but the second one's... He thinks the second one still is pretty great, right? Not as great as the first, but you're kind of going, yeah, it's good, but... So, you bought the French fries, but maybe you eat what? Three of them. Why? Because your blue line is different than his blue line. So there's two differences between these people, where the blue line starts and then how fast it drops. We could also talk about how the red line might differ across people. So let's say you're worried about grease on your clothing and your cars, right? So he's driving around in some junker, right? Wearing some old smock he bought at Kmart 22 years ago. Hasn't been washed for years, right? You're in your lovely Chanel suit, right? Pure wool from, you know, the mountains of South America or something. Now, the cost of getting French fry grease all over the place is higher for who? For him than for you. So that means your red curve is going to do what? Start off higher and go up faster. Make sense? Now, let's turn. We've got the what? The skinny rich bitch. Now, you can be the skinny rich bitch that what? Is a vegetarian. A vegan vegetarian. Okay. So, what does her blue line look like?
Zero.
Probably starts at zero and just goes right across. So for her, the benefits of eating the first French fry aren't worth it. The benefits are less than the costs. So what am I doing here? I'm giving you an example of a marginal decision. And we're talking about it as if we've already bought the French fry bag, and now we're talking about whether we should chew one more French fry. Let's go back to Bubba for a second. If Bubba won the all the French fries you could eat for life contest at McDonald's, does that mean he'd sit in McDonald's for the rest of his life eating French fries? No, because even for Bubba, at some point, enough is enough, right? Think about other commodities. We drew the French fry curve, so French fries for this person started off as a what? A good. Became less and less of a good, and then they turned into a bad. There's lots of things like that. Shots of tequila. Now, shots of tequila, the benefits actually might go up at first, Like, you might enjoy the second shot more than the first shot. But at some point, the benefits to you on a given night of having another shot are going to start going down. And at some point, what's going to happen?
You might actually have the tequila out of you that you just put in you.
Yes, the tequila that went into you might come shooting out of you, right? From orifices in your body, right? Which isn't typically a pleasant sensation, right? It can make you sick, right? Now, one thing I want you to notice, take a look at this footnote here. So, when I look at the cost of eating another French fry when I'm in the car, up to here, when I've described the process, I've described it as there's no money cost because I've already bought the French fries. So once I bought the French fries, the money I spent on the French fries is no longer available for anything else, and I'm not buying another French fry. The bag is already sitting there. But how could we get money costs into this? So sometimes I do consulting. And sometimes what that means is I'm on a telephone call at some meeting, so I'm on the phone and I'm talking, which I can do in the car, driving to Steamboat. But they're paying me a whole bunch of money to talk on the telephone. And let's say I can't talk on the telephone and eat French fries at the same time. In that case, every time I ate a French fry, I'd give up a certain amount of time that I could be talking. Now, in that case, we'd probably want to include the lost wages from me when I chose to eat another French fry. So another example of that sort of thing would be, let's say it's Saturday morning, and there's a telephone call that I could be on, and I could get paid per hour to be on that telephone call. But I decide instead to go biking. My first choice is to go biking. I've given up the money I would have earned if I hadn't gone biking. So part of the opportunity cost of my going biking is those lost wages that I didn't earn because I went biking. So let's back up the decision. Is buying a bag of French fries a marginal decision? Sure. Should I buy another bag of French fries? When we pull into the place, I could buy more than one bag, or I could go back and I could buy a second bag. So that's also, before I make the decision, that's a marginal decision. Should I buy a bag of French fries? What are the benefits? What are the costs? Should I supersize the bag? That's another marginal decision. Now, let's go back to the rich bitch with the Chanel suit, right? Not you, but him. Might she buy a bag of fries? Sure. If maybe she only plans on eating one. But before she buys it, she says, okay, the bag of fries is going to cost $1.50. But I'm rich. What's $1.50, right? But maybe I'm only going to eat one. That's okay. That could be a rational thing. She buys the whole bag and then throws most of them out. So when you buy the bag, that doesn't mean you're planning on eating all the fries in the bag. At least that's how an economist would think about it. And when you get married, are you married? No, not yet. If he gets married, that doesn't mean he's planning on being married forever. It just means he thought getting married for a while was better than not, on the margin. Then if you stay married for another day or another year, that's a marginal decision. Is she worth it for one more year, or should you go off on your own and try and do better? Do you think like that?
No.
No. But that's how an economist would think. And so what you're thinking about in here is you're learning about how economists sort of think about the world, right? Now, she wouldn't buy the bag. Because for her, we know the benefits. There's a positive cost of buying the bag, and she's going to get no benefit from even the first fry. So she's not going to do it. So we were going to talk about this for 10 seconds, weren't we? There's an opportunity cost to that. That means we have less time to talk about other stuff. Think about a firm. Firms also make decisions on the margin. Let's say you own a restaurant, and the restaurant is currently open for lunch and for dinner. Should you open for breakfast as well? That's a marginal decision. You look at what? You look at the expected benefits from opening sooner, earlier. What are the benefits for a firm? Money. You bring in more revenue. So the idea is that if you open earlier, instead of opening at 11:30, you open at 7, you expect your revenues to go up, an increase in revenues, a marginal benefit. But also there's a cost to opening earlier. More electricity, you got to hire more people. So there's a marginal cost. If you think the marginal benefits, the increased revenue, is going to be greater than the increased cost, marginal revenue greater than marginal cost, then you try it out and you open earlier because you think it's going to make your net benefits, which for a firm are what? Your profits go up. Now, if that doesn't work out, maybe you'll stop serving breakfast. But what about the guy who owns the restaurant? And he knows that if he opens earlier for breakfast, his profits will go up. But he'll have to get up earlier. So he'll get less sleep, less beauty sleep. He might reasonably decide what? I mean, one of the costs of opening earlier is less sleep. And if that's worth enough to him, and he doesn't want to give up that less sleep, even though his profits might go up, he might choose not to open earlier because when you take all the costs into account, including the cost of his lost sleep, it's not worth it to him on the margin. Okay. So, a lot of decisions that when economists think about what you're going to do, we often think about should we do a little bit more of it or a little bit less of it? We think about them as marginal decisions. Are all decisions in the world like that? Or are there some decisions that are more just they're so discrete that it wouldn't make sense to think of them in a marginal way? If you do something that drastically changes your world and you can't undo, probably marginal analysis is not the right way to think about it. Another Nobel laureate from the University of Chicago, a guy named Gary Becker, who's written all these famous articles about the family, wrote this article about suicide, the benefits and costs of killing yourself, right? See, that's another weird way that economists think. They might say, well, sometimes it what? Sometimes it makes sense to kill yourself. I wouldn't think of that, and an economist would think like that, I mean, we're not saying that every time somebody kills themselves, it was the right thing to do. But if you think of people as being rational and looking at benefits and costs, if somebody blows their brains out, if they were logical, you'd conclude what? They decided that the net benefits would be higher. The net benefits after you're dead are what? Zero, right? So zero is better than the current life of misery. You know, think about people who are dying of some very painful disease, and there's really nothing that can be done. It's costing their family thousands of dollars a day to keep them alive. You know, assisted suicide. It's now allowed in a number of states, right? I wouldn't think of that as a marginal decision, though. That's a very discreet, you know, getting married is not a marginal decision. In the same way that eating one more French fry is a marginal decision. But as economists, we like to think about decisions on the margin, possibly because we're all frustrated mathematicians who want to explain everything with calculus. But that's another story. So let's talk about specialization. There's going to be a lot more possible trades that can occur that make all the parties to the trade better off if economic agents, instead of producing everything they're going to consume, they specialize in the production of a few things and then trade with other people. So specializing just means devoting most of our productive efforts to producing a few things. So if you think about all the things that you consume, what proportion of them do you produce yourself? And the answer is a very small proportion of the things that you consume. Like right now, a lot of you are specializing in what? Education, right? What am I specializing in at the moment? The production of microeconomic lectures. So I spend a lot of time producing microeconomic lectures, preparing, talking, etc., right? I can't eat them. I can't sleep on them. But I specialize in doing it. Plumbers, on the other hand, they install and repair water distribution systems. They specialize in the production. The reason we do that is because we can all end up with more shit at the end of the day. If you do what you're best at, and I do what I'm best at, and then we trade with each other, we're going to end up with more stuff, consume more stuff, than if you had to produce everything you consumed, and I had to produce everything I consumed. Okay? We specialize because in a market economy with trades, we're made better off with each of us specializing in what we do best. We're going to spend a lot of time in here talking about how to define best, and then we trade. I sell some of the stuff that I was good at producing to you, and in exchange, buy from you some of the stuff I want that you were better at producing than I was at producing. Unless you're, of course, Robinson Crusoe, and then you have to do all your stuff. So I'm going to give all this up. Has anybody ever gone on Etsy? There's all these people now who make their living by making stuff and selling it on this website, Etsy. So I'm going to give up my job here at the university, and I'm going to make decorative switch plates. So you go down to McGuckin's or some hardware store and you buy these switch plates. And then you get all these magazines and you cut out these little pictures of fairies or goblins or teen rock stars or whatever it is you're into, Batman. Cut them out really carefully, get your glue out, you glue them on the switch plates. And then you do what? You sell them on a website. You'd think people would starve doing this, right? But if you go to Etsy, you'll find that there's many, many people in this world who are in the business of making switch plates. Why? Because somebody buys them for money. And so the maker of the switch plate then gets the money. They make a transaction, a trade. And they must be particularly good at this, making these switch plates. They're probably not lawyers that could make $800 an hour. Selling the switch plates, taking the money, and then buying the goods and services that they want to consume. I mean, the bottom line is how many light fixtures can they have in their house? How many switch plates does anyone really need? But they probably make hundreds of these things. And the reason I'm quitting is I think I can do it better than them. You buy these damn switch plates, right? And they don't use enough glue. And you got Tinkerbell or whatever. And if you put it somewhere where there's heavy demand, after a while, Tinkerbell just starts peeling off the switch plates, right? So I figure I can guarantee my switch plates, sell them for a higher price, and make a killing here. Does anybody want to go into business with me? No? So, specialization. What we didn't talk about here, we talked about how people should do what they're good at, which is going to get us in a little while into the topics of advantage. And we're going to talk about different ways you can be good at something or different ways to measure how good you are at something. We're going to talk about absolute advantage, and we're going to talk about comparative advantage. Economists are always talking about equilibrium. And we do that in the context of economic models. We build an economic model, and we assume the solution to that model is some sort of equilibrium concept. So we need to figure out what the hell that word means and how to decide whether a system is or is not in equilibrium. So usually the best way to do things is to start with, sometimes the best way to do things is to start with the definition and then give you some examples. But I'm going to do it ask backwards. I'm going to give you some examples. And once we get a feel for the examples, then we'll say, what do all these examples have in common? What's the definition? So, Wanda Sue and I. Wanda Sue comes up often in this course. You know, we've been married for many, many years. And now we decide we hate each other's guts. So we want to split up. We want a divorce. So I want us to think about lawyers and whether we should hire a lawyer or not, each of us separately. Obviously, we're not going to hire the same lawyer. And what would be an equilibrium in terms of lawyering? Now, let's say we just decided to get divorced. Neither one of us has hired a lawyer yet. Okay? So, I don't have a lawyer. Does Wanda Sue want to lawyer up? How is she going to do if she has a lawyer and I don't? She's going to take me to the laundry. So, if I don't have a lawyer and she doesn't have a lawyer, it's in her interest to do what? Get a lawyer. Wanda Sue wants to, if neither one of us has a lawyer, she wants to change her behavior and get a lawyer. She wants to change things. But at the same time, if Wanda Sue doesn't have a lawyer and I don't have a lawyer, what do I want to do? Get a lawyer, right? Because if I get a lawyer, I'm going to get more of the stuff. So, neither one of us having a lawyer is an equilibrium. What if one of us has a lawyer and the other one doesn't? What does the one who doesn't have the lawyer want to do? Get a lawyer, right? If your soon-to-be ex, who you hate and you're fighting with, has a good lawyer and you don't, get a lawyer. So one party with a lawyer and the other party without a lawyer is also not in equilibrium. What would be an equilibrium where no one would want to change, hire, or fire their lawyer? When both parties have what? They both have lawyers. Oh, you're adding of the same strength? Did you? The same caliber. So if you have a better lawyer than me, yeah, I'd want to get a better lawyer, right? Who's the, what, like 85-year-old dude? Rupert Murdoch? The guy who owns the Wall Street Journal and The Guardian and all these newspapers, trashy newspapers in Australia and England, right? Just served his wife with divorce papers. How old's his wife?
22.
She's not 22. She's kind of, from your perspective, she's an old lady. You know, she's like 45 or something, right? But anyway, he's worth like billions of dollars, right? So, do you think they're both lawyered up? Yes. They both have very, very high-powered law firms working for them. So, everybody lawyered up is in equilibrium. Now, the reason I'm using this example is if you went to a real microeconomics class, the first example that they would give you of an equilibrium would be an equilibrium that somehow we would think of as a good thing. But I want to really point out to you that an equilibrium is not always a good thing. Equilibriums can suck. They can be very inefficient. And this is an example of unless you're a lawyer, this is an example of an equilibrium that sucks. Both parties would be better off if no one had a lawyer. If somehow they could agree not to have a lawyer and they could enforce that on each other, they wouldn't have to give 20% of their wealth to lawyers. But that's not an equilibrium. Because if the other party doesn't have a lawyer, you're better off getting a lawyer. So, we would describe this as an equilibrium, but we describe it as a very inefficient equilibrium. Again, I'm assuming that lawyers don't count for the moment. So, the equilibrium in this game of life is both parties being lawyered up. Right? Now, let's think about another situation. Who's got the bomb? Does the United States have any nuclear devices? Yeah, we got shitloads of them, hundreds of them. How about poor Iran? Do they have any? Do they have one now?
They're right there.
They're close, right? Let's assume they don't have any at the moment. So, what did George Bush call Iran? The evil empire, right? So we have all these bombs, and we don't like Iran. Who else has bombs? Israel has a bunch of bombs. And Israel doesn't like Iran very much. So is us having the bomb and Iran not having the bomb, is that something we describe as an equilibrium? No. Iran wants to do what? Get a bomb as fast as they can, right? Korea's got a bomb now, but it's not a very big bomb, and their delivery system's not very good. Is that an equilibrium? No. Korea wants to get a bigger bomb, right? When I grew up, there was Russia, the Soviet Union, right? And I remember one day, the air raid sirens went off in my town, And I was on my bike, maybe 2 miles from my house. And my only hope, my greatest wish was I would get home before we all got nuked. I was sure we were all going to die in a nuclear holocaust. We used to have these things that were great. At school, we used to have bomb drills in elementary school for a nuclear attack, right? So what do you think we'd do? We'd go in the hall, duck and cover, right? There's a song about that called Duck and Cover. But we had these lockers, but you had to share your locker with another person, right? So you couldn't both fit into the locker. So every other drill, you would take turns getting in the locker. The point was what? The Soviet Union was our big, awful enemy, right? Now, why did we have to have nuclear weapons? Because they had nuclear weapons. Why did they have to have nuclear weapons? Because we had nuclear weapons. If I've got a big stick and you're my enemy, you're going to get a big stick. You have to. You don't want to live in a world where your enemy has a big stick and you don't. It's not an equilibrium. Now, in a perfect world, the Soviet Union and the United States would have made peace, and we would have all agreed neither one of us is going to have any nuclear weapons. But then what would happen? I don't know about them, but I would cheat. And I'd get some nuclear weapons and try and hide them from the other guys. It's not an equilibrium. Now, spending all of our resources, or a large part of our resources in society, building bombs and missiles and all this kind of stuff, I mean, it doesn't make people happier, right? We'd all be happier if there was no threat of getting nuked, probably, anyway. Not all of us, but, you know, the idea of getting nuked can be kind of exciting, I guess, right? Live for the moment, right? Be a good, turns everyone into a Buddhist, right? Live for the moment. Or in the moment, I guess. So, another example of an equilibrium that sucks. So, these guys are working hard to make up some questions about this. And they're going to make up some questions about this song. The song is called Who's Next? And it's by a guy named Tom Lehrer. So, at some point, you should pay attention to the lyrics of this song. You can take the notes online and you can just click on Who's Next? It's a song about who's next to get the bomb. So think about the lyrics. Look at the lyrics. Think about why I'm talking to about the lyrics, how it relates to what we're talking about here, equilibriums, and think about what kind of questions these guys might make up about that. And then as long as you're there at YouTube, you might also want to listen to We Will All Go Together When We Go, which is about nuclear war. Very interesting guy. Mathematician, he started Harvard when he was 15. I think he graduated from Harvard when he was 17 or something like that and got a PhD in math from MIT. And then he went on to this famous singing career. It's quite successful, actually. And then all of a sudden just quit. Okay. Now, let's look at another kind of equilibrium, a market equilibrium. So let's talk more about equilibrium in the way economists would think about an equilibrium. So, I should actually change this. I'm an environmental economist, that's true, but now I own two SUVs rather than one SUV. Let's think about equilibrium in the market for SUVs.